Hello and welcome. You're listening to Queer Quirks on UMFM 101.5, which broadcasts from the University of Manitoba, located on Treaty 1 territory, the lands of the Anishinaabeg, Nehiyawak, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. Now let's take a moment here to acknowledge that land acknowledgements do nothing to return that land to its rightful owners or to pursue justice on the basis of the past history of exploitation and degradation of Indigenous peoples within Canada. So if you haven't already and you can afford to, I strongly suggest that you make a recurring contribution to an Indigenous organization to make a concrete financial action towards pursuing the justice that should be our goal instead of acknowledgement. This is Queer Quirks, a queer talk and music show which examines news, history, culture, and current events through a queer lens. I'm your host, Lee Fraser, they, them, and I'm a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Manitoba. But more importantly for the show, I have a long history of queerness and of advocacy and volunteerism in the queer community. The goals of the show are to showcase artists and creators who are part of minoritized genders and or sexualities, often referred to with initialisms like 2SLGBTQIA+. And I also discuss how events around the world affect queer communities because of how the world treats people who are minoritized genders and sexualities. Often this topic includes mistreatment and violence. I do my best to provide trigger warnings, and please let me know at queerquirks@gmail.com if you feel there's anything I'm missing. I also try to be balanced in my discussion of different groups, particularly if I'm not a member of that group. So wherever possible, I will direct you to further resources and readings or highlight people who are doing work from that perspective that I cannot provide with nuance and genuine understanding. I try to keep the show accessible, which means I rely on publicly accessible work where I can, and where I can't or where I want to highlight something that is not publicly accessible, I will work to provide interpretations and discussion to make it useful to people who have not pursued the particular career that I have. This last is very important because if you are someone who is, for example, bisexual, lesbian, trans, non-binary, if you are anyone who is a part of the groups that I talk about on this show, I believe that you're entitled to work that talks about your life experiences, and you're entitled to it in a form that's useful to you. So, if there is anything that I'm missing or anything that you want to comment on, I strongly encourage you to get in touch because I am always happy to hear about ways that I can understand the world better or work to make the show and what I do more useful and in some cases more entertaining. So let's get into the topic for today. I'm still talking about pronouns, and if you're surprised by this, guess what? Me too. I didn't realize that I had this much in me that would come out surrounding the conversation about pronouns, which is part of why I'm happy to do the radio show in this way, which you can also find essentially as a podcast on the UMFM website, because of the fact that it allows me to spend more time on topics if I don't structure too much and try to be specific at the start of things about what I plan to accomplish that day. And so being a little bit more general and open with those guidelines is definitely working for me in the way that I'm reapproaching this show. And also it's kind of important because it's just the way I've always done things. If you previously listened to the show, there's plenty of occasions where I have said, I want to talk about this and just not gotten to it because there's too much that comes through about other things. There's also, you may not know about, but like many songs that I've wanted to play that I haven't ended up playing on previous shows because I had too much to say about a particular topic. So kind of opening things up a bit more and having more time to spend on things and structuring this more as an ongoing conversation is going to help me and ensure that I do get to or make space for those things, I think, because of the fact that there is always going to be more time to talk about it so I can take a break and play that music. So I was talking around pronouns last week on April 4th, and
some of the discussion around that ended on this mythology about how people will flip out if you get it wrong. And this sort of construction of a marginalized group as overly sensitive is not limited to minoritized gender people. So, of course, there are many instances we can point to of, for example, women being constructed as like feminists who will flip out on you if you so much as hint at misogyny. Women who are feminists, as well as women who are not, live in the world where there's misogyny built into daily lives. So, by and large, this is a ridiculous and very transparent attempt to deflect attention from their own misbehavior by most majority groups employ against people who are asking for their basic human rights in some way, because if you poke at it even a tiny bit, it just falls apart because of the fact that, of course, marginalized folks live in a world that dehumanizes them in numerous ways every day, and that if they did genuinely freak out whenever anyone got something quote-unquote wrong in that sense, and I'm saying it that way because to say someone got it wrong assumes there wasn't the intention to, say, enact misogyny, sexism, transphobia, and so on. So if they genuinely reacted to everything that was wrong and mistreated them in that way, they would never have time for anything else. And also, there are areas of study in, for example, psychology to look at how humans react to that behavior. And there is very little grace extended to marginalized people to allow them to be angry about their mistreatment. And often it directly affects the resources they have access to in terms of the social relationships they need in the workplace or the social currency of going about the world and getting to live in it in the way that anyone else who's putting the same work into it gets to, which they already don't have. But essentially, if you react in this way, if you genuinely react to the dehumanization of your group, often essentially you're penalized for it. So not only is that not the way that marginalized people go about the world, if they did, there's consequences. So this sort of pretentious idea that marginalized people freak out every time they're mistreated even a tiny bit, and we, the well-meaning majority, the well-meaning people with all the structural and social and economic power who are withholding their rights in many cases, we as that group are just trying so hard. And when we get it wrong, and even in the tiniest way, everyone gets so mad at us. And that means that we are the ones that are under attack. It's just garbage. It's just not true. And it is a very, very intentional thing deployed by many, many different groups who hold power in different ways to maintain and consolidate that power. Not only do those groups tend to avoid acknowledging that they have that power. So, for example, again, white people. It's a good example to come to mind for me because I'm in the process of, you know, engaging in anti-racism and dismantling how I view the world and the ways that my whiteness has caused me to see it or not see certain parts of it. So it's an easy thing for me to reach for as an example. But essentially, you know, white people don't usually want to acknowledge the way that they hold more power than other people. And they would like to believe that it's due to their own individual merit and not acknowledge that there are structural factors that come into play. And also, they don't want to think of themselves as doing anything wrong. And white people as a group are not unique in that way, though the intense backflips and world building that we have put into disguising the ways that we hold power over other people is truly incredible. But of course, lots of people don't want to acknowledge ways that they're wrong or ways that they mistreated someone. We see a lot of virtue signaling. We see a lot of social investment now in this idea that if you are openly espousing discriminatory views, you're a bad person. And thus, even if you hold those discriminatory views, usually you don't want to be viewed that way. And if you view yourself as someone who is non-discriminatory, which is basically impossible for the most part, because we're all embedded in systems that discriminate, and most of us have picked up in different ways and have to actively interrogate them to get them out of the way that we navigate the world. But if you want to view yourself as a good person and you're very invested in this idea, you don't like any instance that calls out the fact that you might not be. Or in many cases, you have been praised in an over-the-top way for accomplishing even the littlest bit of extending humanity. So the amount of time that white people put into clapping themselves on the back for quote-unquote giving people their rights or things like that is incredible. There is a lot of self-congratulation in some cases for simply the act of no longer oppressing someone, which is not giving someone their rights. You're just no longer actively withholding them in a certain way, and usually in a way that has been so minutely legislated that you can still withhold those rights in a variety of other ways. So there's so many problems with trying to center yourself in a conversation around someone else's rights, and there is a lot bound up in the fact that that is often an intentional act. Even if you don't consciously acknowledge it to be intentional, basically overreacting if someone calls you out for something that you've done is a method to get the attention back on yourself and to dismiss or ignore the actual harmful thing that you did, to keep the conversation all about you. And this also, this construction of other people as constantly angry or upset or emotional about their rights being taken away, sort of allows you to put this picture up of them as an irrational group that you couldn't possibly please and who's really making a big deal out of nothing. So when cisgender folks try to construct this idea of minoritized gender people as getting so upset if they are misgendered, that is something that does help cisgender people as a group. It makes them look better for the bad things that they are doing. It distracts from the fact that they are the ones doing the bad things. It distracts from how much or little effort they might be making. It distracts from the fact that often they are intentionally misgendering and viciously attacking people who don't sit within their group of gender. And it allows them to sort of have this deniability or pretense that they did it accidentally or that, you know, the other person is getting upset over nothing. And so, again, there are some people who might get upset, but there is certainly no way to generalize this as a group. And again, if people were upset about being misgendered, purposely or non-purposely, they really do have a right, just like how people have a right to get upset over other forms of oppression and discrimination. But the fact is that's not usually what happens. The fact is that usually marginalized people have to very carefully navigate their way to trying to regain their rights, and they have to treat their oppressors with a lot more graciousness than they are treated. But even if people did react strongly to being misgendered, maybe that's a reason to learn to ask people's pronouns or something and not make assumptions. And not something that you should be using as a way to sort of excuse not making any kind of effort. Now, I'll be clear though, and I have been pretty clear in previous episodes, and I cannot stress this or say this often enough. This is a myth though. That is not how minoritized gender people react. There's certainly no evidence that I have seen to suggest that that is a common reaction. There's plenty to show us that they would face consequences for reacting that way, and there are already people who often cannot afford to face those consequences in the form of like social ostracism or a lack of opportunities or things like that. So I would say that most minoritized gender people have in fact encountered many, many cisgender people who are more than willing to take away whatever minor acts of respect that they've given them if that minoritized gender person offends them in any way. And I talked about that a bit in the last episode, how fundamentally wrong that view is and how smug and shitty an expression of quote-unquote allyship that is when you pretend that you support someone's right but like only if they're nice to you. Because even if every person I see who is a member of a particular marginalized group, for example, that I see today is really, really mean to me, that doesn't mean that I'm entitled to take away their human rights. It just doesn't. And so that is not the way that we as a society view things. And it's only something, we only get away with it and we only mistreat people who are marginalized, who don't really have the ability to make waves in that department. So it's also something that I think is a fantasy for cisgender people of, oh, there's, no matter what I did, it would never be right, or it would never be enough, or, oh, I'm trying and that should be enough. Like I shouldn't have to really actively look to see if I'm still doing things wrong. Like maybe I've made one tiny change and I should be applauded for that. It's a way that I think is used to distract from social discomfort about making a mistake or not making a change or feeling that if you do make a change, maybe you'll get it wrong. And the correct way to deal with that is to look for resources or to ask people how they want to be treated or to educate yourself on treating other people with humanity. But instead, many people sort of use this as a pretext for giving up and saying, this marginalized group, in this case, minoritized genders, are an irrational, demanding group, and we can never make them happy anyway, so we shouldn't even try to treat them as humans. And I am going to try now to move on from that myth for today because it keeps being something that draws me back in because I'm so upset about it and I find it so transparently not true and useless and generally only used to invalidate the responses that people might have to being mistreated that are valid. So, there is also myths about pronouns and the idea that if you ask someone's pronouns, essentially that they'll be offended. I've talked about at length in previous episodes in different ways. So the way I want to highlight today is that the offense often comes from this idea that if you ask someone's pronouns, what you are telling them is that you cannot interpret their gender for yourself from how they present. And what you're really usually saying is, I won't interpret your gender from what you're presenting. Instead, I'm going to ask you and ensure that I'm gendering you correctly. So instead of misgendering you and waiting for you to correct me, I'm just going to ask to start with, which is also a way to remind people that they cannot presume other people's genders without asking. So I think that cisgender folks are offended by this in two or three ways. One, I think that they are offended at the idea that in some way their gender presentation is ambiguous. So there's a very toxic idea that if somehow you don't perform femininity or masculinity enough, that there's something wrong with you. And so from the perspective of the cisgender person, I think sometimes they are thinking, I would only ask someone's gender if I couldn't tell. And because I think if I couldn't tell, that means there's something wrong with them. This person is saying there's something wrong with me. The other reason I think that cisgender folks don't like to ask about pronouns is they don't like to be reminded that there are more than just the genders that they generally accept. There's a social investment in a lot of really simplistic ideas. And in some areas, say, not understanding or learning beyond really simple ideas that you're taught in, say, like high school or grade school, in some ways that's not necessarily harmful. I probably have some very simple ideas about math or about chemistry, where, say, something has been described to me in ways that are oversimplified and not entirely correct, but were useful for my learning at that level. That's true. And unless I try to do a degree or do a career in chemistry without like going and getting a degree in that, it's probably not going to actively harm a lot of areas of my life. But where you can interact with people socially and you have these very simplified ideas, oversimplifications that are not accurate and not a good reflection of the world around us, you can do harm because you can continue to navigate the world with this perception, one, that it is limited and that limited view is correct with the evidence, which it's not. The gender binary is not something that is supported by the evidence in a number of areas, including endocrinology, biology, and so on. But also, it's the one that you're socially invested in. And so if there is any threat to that, that can threaten your kind of worldview. And if you are someone who is in the quote-unquote correct area of that, it means that you're no longer at an advantage if you give that up. If the very simplified binary view of gender is genuinely the way things are in your view, then you, by being a good binary gender person and living your life and going along and, like, I don't know, wearing skirts and lipsticks if you're a lady, you are doing something right, and other people who don't do that are doing something wrong. So that gives you a moral high ground. It puts you in the right. And so if there's no longer a right and wrong in that sense, then it's threatening to that advantage that you have. So you kind of had this sort of smug vision of yourself as above other people. And if there isn't a right or wrong way, or if there's numerous ways to view right or wrong in terms of gender, if there's numerous ways to view gender in general, then that means that there's no longer people who are unambiguously in the wrong, and that means that you're not unambiguously in the right. And that's upsetting to a lot of people because maybe they haven't enjoyed performing gender in this specific way, but they've done it because it's the quote unquote right thing to do. And they want the accolades and the advantages that they think that they've earned by doing that. Or maybe they are happy being that way and it gives them advantage over other people because they just happen to be in line with what's wanted. And so they're angry if it's suggested that there's other ways, because if there's no wrong way, then again, they are not better than other people for doing it quote unquote right. So we can see this in other aspects of gender as well. So for example, there are some people who enjoy being like the caretaker of a home and the manager of a household and someone who puts things together and does meals and cooking and does all that really skillfully, might be, if they are a woman, considered a very good woman, the exemplary woman. And sometimes people who had that career and views were threatened by, say, movements in feminism that said women can do more than that. Because if women could only do that, and I was really, really good at that, and other people kind of weren't, because not everybody's necessarily good at one job, then that meant that I am at the top of my category. I am one of the ones that's doing it right. And since there's very limited options, there's not that many people who will be the one who's exemplary. If we are limiting, we generally can see now that we're starting to view women as people, that very narrow ideas of what a woman can be are really hard to fulfill. So if you hit the jackpot and you fulfilled those things, you were the person who looked really good in that category. You were at the top almost effortlessly because that happened to be what you wanted to do. And maybe you got to more easily be dismissive of people who didn't want to do that because you're like, oh, it is natural for women because it's natural for me, which is a fundamental misunderstanding of the fact that other people can be different from you. But it was upsetting to some people when that category was opened up. For one, they thought, oh, if there's alternatives, those people are saying those alternatives are better. Maybe some people did present it that way, but by and large, feminism has said there's a lot of value in the home and we don't value it enough. We don't value this unpaid labor that a lot of people do for their families and put out into the world, in the sense that, like, fulfilling the social and emotional and physical needs of a household is valuable. And if you didn't have someone who is doing the unpaid labor as a family member, you'd have to pay a number of people who do that professionally to do it. So by saying that we don't value that labor enough, most feminist movements have made it, because there is multiple feminisms, just like there's multiple versions of any movement that is large and diverse. Most feminisms, I would say, don't say that there's something wrong with being a housewife or any other word for that role. They actually say that we don't value it enough, but that there's other ways that women can do things. That's not the only option. But if there's other options and you're just one of many and people can succeed in a variety of ways, then you're not special anymore. So people who were really good at that one area kind of had a choice to either say, yeah, I just happened to be really well suited for this and this was what I wanted to do, so it worked for me whether we were limited to that or not, and I'm going to continue doing it and push maybe to be valued properly. Or they can say, no, we should stick to the one way, the one thing that women are allowed to do because I'm good at it. And if we say women can only do that thing, then I get to be the one who's good at that thing, and thus I am the only good one out of all the women. So how that relates to gender, in terms of minoritized genders as well, and in terms of pronouns, is that if you have an idea that you are better than other people because you are cisgender, because you are one of the two groups that are presumed by that really simplistic idea of gender to be correct, then if you accept that there is more to gender than just those groups, then you lose that. You don't get to be the one right person because you have to acknowledge there's more than one way to be right and that other people are not doing it wrong. And we know that if there's more people in, for example, a group and some of them are not doing well and some of them are doing well, essentially you can kind of stand out if you do well. And if you're in a group and you're all being evaluated on your strengths and maybe everyone kind of does well, there are people who will always be upset by that. And those people don't have a security in just the fact that they do well and they have confidence in their own competence in that way. They sort of depend on other people being degraded or not doing well to prop themselves up and to show how good they are. And so those people can be the people who are very invested in, for example, assumptions about pronouns, because I am performing being a man or being a woman in a way that tells you that I'm a man or a woman, and that's expected. And since I'm doing it right, I'm always going to get the right pronouns, and anyone else who doesn't like those pronouns is wrong. Who, like, say we have two women who dress in a beautiful flowered dress, and one of them is a woman, and one of them use, or sorry, we have two people who dress, see, I already gendered my example wrongly. Say we have two people who are wearing a beautiful dress. Let's say a beautiful dress with dinosaur bones on it that glow in the dark, because I have one of those, and it's awesome. It's very Miss Frizzle of me, and I love it. So I'm wearing that dress and lipstick and heels and looking real cute. And there's another woman that I know who's wearing a dress and lipsticks in that dress and looking real cute. That woman uses she, her pronouns. And I'm not a woman and I use they, them pronouns. But we're both performing one idea of what something looks like. So we're both performing a gender expression that people associate with femininity. And one of the advantages or ways that your path is eased if you are a cisgender woman is that if you perform that way, you will always be correctly gendered. So you might feel that's your due to always be correctly gendered and always be able to depend on that assumption. And if you acknowledge that there's other people who can look like you, but who are not the same as you, and that we maybe have to ask to know how people are, then you don't have that unearned advantage. You can't just depend on assumptions. And you also maybe can't chastise people for performing femininity in a way that is not looking like you, because it's a way to penalize people if they get misgendered because they don't perform a binary gender well enough. It's a way of saying, well, if you're a guy, but you wore lipstick and people treated you as a woman, it's your own fault for wearing lipstick. Lipstick doesn't have a gender. There's a variety of gendered expressions and gendered things that can have nothing to do with how we're addressed with our pronouns, but we're accustomed to using them to signal to other people how we want to be treated. And so it's kind of like an unspoken, easy thing. So instead of having to stop and put on a name tag, you go into a room and everybody already knows your name. And you feel so good about that, that you oppose name tags. So if you are someone whose whole personality happens to say Elizabeth, and I'm somebody whose personality doesn't say Elizabeth, but whose name is Elizabeth, you go throughout the world and you presume that we should always decide what someone's name is before we talk to them, because your personality somehow says Elizabeth so much that you don't have to worry about being called by any other name. And my personality doesn't scream Elizabeth, even if that's the name I use. So I have to say, ask me what my name is, or let's wear name tags. And you don't like that because you are used to not having to do anything to be treated the way that you want. And so you are used to relying on this assumption. So I have used the example of coffee before. I have another example that I do want to talk about that I think actually even suits us a little better. So I talked about coffee last week about, in the last couple weeks, about the idea of coffee and like not wanting to ask about gender being this, or sorry, not wanting to ask about pronouns being similar to not wanting to say how you like your coffee and just sort of assuming everyone should know. And maybe everyone does always get it right for you, so you don't think we should ever have to say how we want our coffee. But I'm going through the world and people can't psychically read my coffee order, so I have to say what it is out loud. And so a new standard is adopted where we all just say what we want in our coffee. And it doesn't negatively impact that person, except that they can't glide through on the assurance that theirs is the only right way to have coffee, because that's the way it's traditionally immediately served, and everybody else has to kind of jump through hoops to get their coffee in the way that they want. So we are both navigating our right, which is to have coffee the way that we want it, and you have always had a very, very easy way. So the tiniest kind of change that just says, hey, you should just have to kind of say that that's what you want, instead of just assuming that you'll get it, so that way people who don't usually get what they want can be a normal part of society while saying what they want. So the analogous part of gender to this would be that if you go about the world and people assume she, her pronouns for you, and you object to being asked about your pronouns or asking for other people's pronouns, you're saying people usually get it right for me, so I don't think that we should ever have to ask. And part of the problem with that I can talk about later as well, or I have talked about in previous episodes, is that it really singles out people who do ask about pronouns or who present in a way that people read ambiguously and have to ask about. And it suggests still that it is normal to presume that we know how to address someone. And it also erases people who present themselves in a way that we see as associated with that assumption they make about you, but the assumption they're making about that other person wouldn't be correct. So I have an example that I think actually is even better for that, but I'm going to give you that example in just a sec here, and I'm going to play you another song by Imbi the Girl, and this one is called Conversations.
Okay, this might sound crazy, a little bit strange, but I can't help feeling a little deranged when I think of you these days. When I think of you these days, I can't help it, every time I think of you my heart stops. I swear to God it's better than when the beat drops in all those songs I listen to on my way to work while flirting with a fantasy of you. I know that both of us are pretty awkward, so getting intimate is gonna be very difficult, but it doesn't matter to me, cause baby I just wanna intimately conversate with you. I don't care if it's romantic, I don't care if there's no love, all I know is that I'm frantic, seems I'm drawn to you from above. I know that it seems pedantic, the things I'm saying don't. Calling, oh, you're calling to my chest. It's my center of so many things, femininity and all my creativity. All my strength and my foundation is not stationary, and you consume all of that, you occupy all of that. Can't you see that it's ridiculous for me to stop and think of you or try to make a fuss? Cause I know you told me once that you were with a girl, and I know that we both want it, but could I destroy her world? Because no love, all I know is that I'm frantic, seems I'm drawn to you from above. I know that it seems pedantic, the things I'm saying don't make sense. All I know is that you're calling, oh, you're calling to my chest.
Okay, so that was Conversations by Imbi the Girl, and I think it's kind of a really good representation in some ways, not all, because it's a song, can't perfectly fit my show, but it really does work for me in this moment of trying to have kind of longer conversations over the course of several shows, sometimes to kind of give an opportunity to sketch around these different concepts that are really complex and that we, because we're humans and we have an interesting and evolving history, are never going to be able to pin down in black and white. And so that is something that I think also bothers people who object to things like asking about pronouns. I do find it really, it was very shocking to me at first that people object to it. I can understand the kind of social awkwardness, because having a new thing that you ask, especially if it's unexpected or if people judge you for it, which a lot of people who are kind of bigoted and annoying do. Like, oh, you're asking about pronouns, oh, that's a, oh, we're being all so respectful, oh, because everyone's so individual and unique. No, you're not especially unique, you're kind of a piece of shit, but I'm still going to call you by the correct pronouns, because that's how we do. And I am interested in having conversations with people that correctly refer to them. I have an interest and investment in correctly and accurately referring to the world that maybe not everyone does have, and it's kind of a nerdy interest of mine, but also, I mean, I'm socially awkward, so I understand that it becomes socially awkward to incorporate a new thing into our social lexicon. Don't love it. Don't love talking to people. Guess what? I'm still doing it, and I don't love talking to people that object and are kind of like smug and annoying about questions that respect someone's personhood. But I have to talk about them because they make up part of the world, so if I have to deal with that, you can deal with asking about someone's pronouns so that you refer to them correctly. And again, this is not a preference. This is not an accommodation. This is not some sort of special thing that you're going above and beyond and you're a special hero ally to offer. It is accuracy. It is in its simplest form, ensuring you are correct in the way that you're talking about someone. In the way that if I talked about a public figure and I continuously referred to them by the wrong gendered pronoun, most people would correct me because they have an interest in accuracy and they think it's confusing or wrong to talk about someone with a pronoun that is not the pronoun that that person uses. So, if I were to talk about, for example, who's someone the public knows? John Mulaney, comedian, well known. If I were to talk about John Mulaney and I continually refer to John Mulaney as she, people around me would recognize that as being wrong. If someone else is talking about me and continually refers to me as she or refers to me as he, they would be wrong because I am a they. That is the gendered pronoun that I use, or in this case, non-gendered, but there's a variety of pronouns beyond that. They, them is honestly one of the simplest and already integrated into the English language to use. So if you're not using the correct pronoun for me, you're being lazy and you're being wrong and you're kind of being shitty. So there is so much that shapes our interactions with each other, and there is nothing unique or unusual or special about asking to be treated as a human in a way that other people already are. You only see it as special because you are trying to withhold it from other people. You only see it as special because you like to think of yourself as the only type of person in the world, and because you hold enough power sometimes to withhold that from other people, you're able to do that. So, again, that is not something that is unusual in human history. There are numerous people in our political history in Canada who have acted as if they were conferring some sort of special privilege on women by allowing roughly half the human population to vote in their government. Something that ironically has been enshrined as a democratic right for years before that, but because women weren't people, nobody had a problem with how they weren't voting. Nobody, meaning the people in charge who were continuously preventing them from having that, didn't have a problem with it and saw it as real special when women wanted that, even though men already had it. So we should not see it as real special when minoritized genders want to be referred to correctly, because you already have that if you're not a minoritized gender. And by the same vein, we shouldn't see asking about pronouns as something special and unusual and over the top that we're being asked to do. Because one, it is a simple, tiny question. And if you are making a big deal about it, you are an infant baby. And one, you're either literally an infant baby and we're not asking anything of you because you can't talk. Or the other option, you are someone who's an adult who's behaving as an infant baby and you shouldn't be allowed to participate in society because you can't understand why you should treat other people as humans too. So that is very important to me because I am so tired of the dramatics around asking about pronouns. Oh, it's such a big deal. Oh, it's so much work for me. Oh, I'm offended that people can't just inherently tell I'm a man or a woman. Aren't I manning hard enough? Get over it. It's the same sort of thing of being offended if someone, you know, doesn't presume you're a heterosexual, which one presumes that heterosexuality is something that everyone already is, which is part of heteronormativity, and that's dumb and not accurate. Or also it sets up heterosexual as the correct way to be. And by even questioning the possibility you might not be heterosexual, someone is inferring that you might be a member of another group that you think is bad. So that's just your own bigotry. And you need to deal with that, and that's a you problem. Don't make it society's problem. So I don't have any patience or sympathies for all the histrionics around being asked to start using a small basic question. To being told, as a society, we're basing this practice on assumption, and that is bad. For instance, when we enter a room in a business setting and there is a woman in there, we might ask her what her role is. In previous years, we might have assumed that she was the secretary or that she was the waitress or any other feminine gendered role and be shocked if she was the CEO or something. But that's not the way the world is. And just because you could assume every woman in the room was a secretary for a really long time, doesn't mean that all women are or should be secretaries. And it doesn't mean that something massive is being asked of you if you start entering a room and introducing yourself and asking someone what their role is, rather than presuming that you can judge on the basis of how they look what their role is. And this can apply to a variety of ways that we picture things, such as presuming somebody isn't in a role of leadership because of their skin color or the way that they're dressed or their height or things like that. All of these presumptions are shown to be inaccurate in a number of ways. And sometimes they are assumptions that we feel pretty confident in because, say, if we enter a room and there's mostly men in it and men have held most of the leadership roles throughout our lives because, you know, for many years to various degrees and continuing now, we've been pushing other genders out of those roles and actively making it more common for white men to hold those roles. So if we enter a room, yeah, maybe we'd be more likely to be correct if we presumed that the white man was in charge. That is a sad fact of our institutions. But it's not a universal, and it's not a reason to always assume that the white man is in charge, because you will sometimes be wrong, and there's nothing super special about asking who's in charge. Just like how you might think if I see someone in lipstick and heels and I assume they use she, her, usually that is true. And so I should get to just say that all the time and never have to ask. Nah, let's just ask. Not that big a change, not that hard to do. Don't pitch a fit just because you're being asked to not assume anymore. It's just lazy. So I do want to highlight that there is one thing where you might get a negative response for someone who has been regularly misgendered or someone who's trans who's navigating the world. And I do want to say that, as I mentioned before, that sometimes it's reasonable for people to react negatively to being misgendered, partly because it's been weaponized against them, partly because it is something that might have occurred with great frequency and you are kind of hitting the end of their rope in that way. Like, you are the most recent person to be kind of scraping at their skin in a way that's been going on all day, and you happen to be the person who hits the vein, who really hurts them, who's the final person to cause that injury. So there's a variety of reasons that people might react that way. And I do want to acknowledge and say this: sometimes trans folks, in particular binary trans folks, are sometimes trying to convey with their appearance femininity. Sometimes trans women, for example, are expected to perform hyper-femininity to sort of justify their right to be a woman, whereas a cis woman is allowed to, I don't know, wear sweatpants and still be a woman, even if we kind of judge her for not being feminine enough. Similarly, trans men might be expected to be very manly. And so those people, either by inclination or because they'll receive more respect on that basis, might be pushed into presenting a very feminine or very masculine appearance. And since they've gone to all that effort because of the fact that the world is assuming and relying on those cues for their gender, they might be intentionally catering to that presumption of gender, and especially for previous generations where that was really required and you weren't given the option of someone asking about your pronouns, there are some people who might be a little bit touchy if they are a trans person who is very clearly performing and projecting something that they believe should be met with a particular gendered pronoun. Now, sometimes you see this in binary trans folks who are not open or accepting of other minoritized genders. It's sad, it's ironic, but that is a thing that happens. Within communities, there are still people who are intolerant or dismissive of other people's identities. And there is hierarchy still, and sometimes binary trans folks who have fought very hard for kind of a seat at the table of gender, for being acknowledged and treated as their gender, might then turn around and dismiss other people because they've gained legitimacy and they want to distance themselves by investing in a system that puts legitimacy in these categories, and they want to gain something from that category. So they don't want to, say, accept some of the gender diversity. Or they want to say, I've waited for years and years to be able to say wear lipstick and heels and be thus assumed and treated as a woman, and I don't want to give that up. That assumption means something to me. However, again, there are people who look and act like that who don't use she, her, or for whom that's not their identity. And the fact is, those people exist, and having access to a privilege that has been denied you doesn't mean that you should get to turn around and deny it to someone else. And that is sometimes how things work. Often people in marginalized groups are intentionally divided by others so that they sort of fall to infighting, or sometimes if they gain a right, they don't want kind of other people, because there's a sort of this perspective that there's only so many rights to go around, which is in some respects true, not in true in the reality of the fact, but true in the sense that the regimes that are in power are usually only willing to kind of go so far and be like, ah, we've granted humanity to women. That's enough for today. That's enough human rights for today. Let's wait another 50 years before we start granting humanity to gay women, you know? And so we do see historically this kind of getting a little bit forward, but there's always people who are left out of that. And so there are people within movements who are so worried that they won't get their foot in the door that way, that they try to distance themselves from other groups that they think are less likely or less close in the battle of rights. And it has been, like, trans folks probably wasn't a great example for me to use in that, in binary trans folks, because binary trans folks and all people who are not cisgender have historically been the group who is left behind. So there is a lot of nuance in how people react, and there's a lot of history behind things. So basically you have to treat people as individual people, and they might react differently, and it's not reflective of their whole group. I know, it's complicated. It's how humans are in the world, so we have to sort of pull up our pants and deal with that. So I do want to talk a little bit about, beyond this kind of discussion of pronouns, what it means to ask about pronouns or to put your pronouns, for example, in your email signature, something that I've seen a lot of people doing. So some of the argument about asking about pronouns is sort of like, well, I shouldn't have to do it. Like, if I see someone who is trans, I'll ask about their pronouns. So I'll make sure that I respect them. I just, like, shouldn't have to do it myself or ask other people that I know are cisgender. There's a couple problems in that. You assume that you can know if someone's cisgender, which is not true. And you also assume that you will be able to identify anyone who doesn't use the pronouns that you think are appropriate for them. So again, it's a kind of different investment in that system of assumptions. It's saying like, oh, I'll ask, but only if someone clearly gives me messages that I think associate them with a group that would use different pronouns than I assume they would. So that's something that does erase the fact that there are people who go about the world, as I always like to say, we walk among you, that you don't clock them as someone you would need to ask about their pronouns. And the reason for that is that you cannot identify us as being different from you all the time. And sometimes when you can, people are sending very clear messages with their clothing or their mannerisms that they are someone who is, you know, performing a really cool gender queering and visibly, you know, exuding hypermasculinity and hyperfemininity, something that really messes with our ideas of what people look like. And you're like, ah, I do have to ask about that person. Sometimes it's a person who looks just like you and four other people that you know that you also assume that you can correctly gender them. And sometimes people for whom, again, they go about the world and can expect to be correctly gendered are misgendered by circumstances or things that remove some of those cues. So there's not really a downside to asking, and there's a lot of positives. And also any limitation on asking, of saying I'll ask but only with certain people, still relies on that presumption that you can and should be the one to judge whether you need to ask pronouns. Again, you can't judge someone's pronouns, so you can't judge which situations you need to ask in, because that's still kind of just drawing back on the assumption a little bit and saying, like, I believe I have the right to decide for, say, 90% of people, and 10% of people, if they send me clear enough signals, I will ask to ensure that I'm right. No, let's just not assume that we're right about anyone. Let's just ask and then we can be sure. So one way that I think about this as well is dogs. So I'm a dog person. I like dogs. If somebody's dog comes and jumps on me and licks my face, honestly, I feel blessed. I feel chosen. I'm usually okay with it. I think it's a lovely experience. However, that doesn't mean that that person is entitled to just walk around the neighborhood letting their dog jump on everyone and assuming that everyone wants kisses like I do, you know? So it's something where you cannot go through the world and assume you'll always be correct about how someone wants to be treated, particularly if it affects them in a negative way. So just because I confirm their assumptions on that point, so just because you correctly gender Susie at work, you meet her, you think, ah, Susie has long hair and she's wearing earrings, she must use she, her pronouns. And so you kind of, you know, figure that out and you feel very Sherlocky, you've picked up on those cues, you got what she's putting down, you got her correct pronouns. Okay, just because you correctly gendered Susie doesn't mean you're going to correctly gender the next person who walks in the door who has a similar appearance, who doesn't use those pronouns, whose gender is not that way. And similarly, just because someone walks down the street and their adorable golden retriever jumps on me and gives me a lick on the face and I'm fine with it, doesn't mean that they should presume that the next five people are also going to be fine with that. So just because your assumptions have been sort of proven correct in one way doesn't mean that you should continue or can continue operating on those assumptions. So that's an analogy. Again, I'm not great at like analogies and metaphors, but that's another analogy I kind of thought of to help deal with things, just because I don't mind if people, or I could see myself not minding if people assume their dog wants to greet me, because I always want to greet dogs. But if I was okay with a world in which we just let dogs run up to every person, that would be really a crap, disrespectful friendship move of mine towards a number of my friends who come from different locations where dogs have, like, say, often been used for protection or are usually hostile, and so they don't like that. So being okay with the world because it works from my experience, and ignoring something because it's not a problem for me in particular, is a really, really bad way to go about the world, because we're all going to be different in some respect, and so we need everyone to be on board with making sure that we proceed respectfully. Because just because you can assume for 60% of a group and you're in that 60% doesn't mean that you're going to be in that 60% on another issue. So if we have to be, we got to be respectful and treat people as humans in one way, damn, we have to be respectful and treat them as humans in every way. Oh, shucks. So much work for all of us treating people as humans. So that's another aspect of invisibility. So that's another way where cisgender folks can say, well, because it's not a problem for me. I'm going around on my walks and dogs run up to me, and it's not a problem for me. So that would be the same as I'm going around on my walks as a cisgender man, and people always call me he, him. So pronouns aren't a problem for me. Or if we reverse that, I'm going on walks with my dogs and I'm letting them jump on every person because I can always tell 100% that these people are okay with that. So I should be able to go about the world and do that. Maybe some of those people were being polite. Maybe some of those people thought that I looked annoying or mean and weren't up for an argument, so they didn't comment on the fact that I was just letting my dogs jump all over them. Maybe if I had asked, I could ensure that I treated each of those people with respect to their bodily autonomy and their proximity to my dogs. So you see how we come full circle in how it's just not that hard in most cases. I will say that, I mean, there's issues around human rights that are hard and that require changes, that require us to understand more deeply our kind of fundamental differences in between different groups of people. But there's some instances where a specific change we're being asked to make is not that hard. And sometimes the change simply reflects this idea that we're not in charge. I am not the end-all and be-all judge of who wants my dog's breath in their face. And while it might be hurtful to me to give up that power, maybe I'm really invested. Maybe I get a lot of satisfaction from the idea that I always correctly judge who my dogs want to see. And I want to ignore the discomfort of people because I want to cling to that idea. That would make me a bad neighbor. That would make me someone that eventually probably got complaints or got charged with something. That would just be bad behavior on my part. Similarly, if you are going about the world and you are very invested in the idea that you are the end-all be-all person who gets to judge their gender and how to refer to them, maybe it is a little bit of a feeling of loss to you that you're not in that powerful position. But the fact is that you never were. You were likely getting it wrong. Maybe sometimes you were getting it right, but it wasn't based on some magical finger-twiddly ability to psychically divine how someone wanted to be referred to. It was, you know, reading social cues, which many of us do. And the fact is that we may not always know if we're reading social cues right. So if we do it wrongly, we only know if someone corrects us. And sometimes it is not safe or it comes with consequences to correct someone. So you might be presuming that you know the pronouns for 9 different people and 4 of them don't use the pronouns that you've chosen to use for them. So you're feeling very smug about your ability to correctly gender everyone when in reality, maybe those 4 people work under your jurisdiction and they are afraid to tell you. They are afraid there might be backlash or consequences or that it's uncomfortable to be in the position of correcting someone who's in a superior position within a company. So there are a lot of reasons why just asking and making it clear that you are open to asking is really important. And if you are someone who puts it out there that you're a respectful person, people will feel comfortable to you. Maybe you're going to retain different kinds of talent than your competitors because people who are minoritized in other ways are going to feel comfortable around you. They're going to look at your email signature and say, oh, this person puts they, them in their email signature. Or they're going to look at your email signature and it says he, him. So you could be cis, you could be trans. But so you could be part of that group that has more power, but they might feel more comfortable working for you because they know from your signature that you are someone who acknowledges that you can't make these assumptions about people. Maybe that means that you're more likely to be someone who's invested in challenging stereotypes in other ways. Maybe you're someone who is going to be more likely to acknowledge that someone, for example, doesn't work in housekeeping because they're Latino, or someone isn't in a position of lower power because they're a woman. So maybe you are going to be someone who acknowledges that the world can be different for different people, and individual people have individual skills and rights and humanity, and that you are not lazily defaulting to a system of power that puts people into neat little boxes just because it's easy for you. That's a lot to convey with pronouns in your signature, and I'm not saying that everyone is going to take it that way, but I am saying it's the start of a message that you can send out about yourself, that you are someone with whom, for example, if I went to work for you, I wouldn't have to put up with the specter of possible threats and dehumanization and dismissive attitudes towards my correct pronouns. And usually if a cisgender man, for example, went to work for a company, he wouldn't have to face that specter. And I want you to think, if you're a cisgender man, would you want to go work for somebody who was going to call you she all day and ignore you when you tried to correct them, or think that it wasn't important, or laugh in your face? If there was someone who was going to refer to you incorrectly every day or intentionally to degrade you, you probably wouldn't want to work for them. You'd probably identify it as toxic, shitty behavior. And so that is what most minoritized gender folks are faced with navigating, is that unless we know explicitly that somebody is on our side, it's very possible that they're anywhere on a range of behaviors that can go from overtly violent to kind of covertly shitty and dismissive. So there's a lot going on with that, and there's a lot of ways that you can send the message that you are somebody who is not garbage. But asking about pronouns or putting pronouns in your signature, that's one of them. It's a small, basic step. And it also has the benefit that you'll be correctly gendered. Maybe one day you're going to show up all muffled in a coat and scarf, or maybe you're someone whose body morphology doesn't conform to the binary expectations in a certain way, and you're going to show up and there's a possibility that you'd be misgendered, but because you put your pronouns in your signature, people know the way to refer to you. So you avoid that. Everybody wins. There's really no downside. If you think there is a downside to this, come at me. Either you'll identify a nuanced issue with gender for me that I was previously unaware of, which, thank you, love it, or just fight me, you're wrong. So that's where I'm going to end my conversation on gender and pronouns and navigating society with respect for humanity today. It's a complicated topic and there's so much more to visit, and I am going to try to bounce through some more lighthearted stuff as well on the show. So if you are interested in conversations on representation and on non-binary folks just existing in the world and knowing about more of them, I will post an article, because I want to end on a cool note, that John Cameron Mitchell recently came out as non-binary, so that's very exciting. John Cameron Mitchell, you might know most recently for the role of Joe Exotic in the dramatization of Netflix's Tiger King. And Tiger King is a glorious, ridiculous complication and problem, and there's just so much going on in there. So I mean, if you are interested in a show that unambiguously reminds you that LGBTQ people, 2SLGBTQIA people, minoritized genders and sexualities are not a monolith, then you probably want to go see Joe Exotic's Representation of Gay Identity, because he is not a person that I would say I have a lot in common with in many ways, but we're both part of a minoritized sexuality community, so we've got that in common. And it's just, it's glorious. So highly recommend. Check that out. And I will be back next week.